Hi, this is 180 Degrees, a show about the changes we all need to make for a clean energy future. Brought to you by SEAI. Episode 3, your questions about upgrading your home.
So in this episode, we're going to answer some burning questions we have been asked by the public about home energy efficiency. Hello everyone, Tom Halpin here. Talking to us today about all things cost is Lisa O'Brien, quantity surveyor, known to many of you for keeping Dermot in check on Room to Improve. We also have SEAI's very own architect, Jenny Power, and home retrofit specialist, Brian McIntyre. Hello to you all.
Hello.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Tom.
So, Lisa, it's great to have you with us. How have you been keeping?
Good. Thanks for having me here this morning.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you in. So, how did you find your time on Room to Improve? Because that's where most people will know you from.
Very challenging. Yeah. No, really enjoyed it. It was a great 2-year stint to be on the show. Like behind the scenes, there's so much going on. So what you guys actually see on the 58 minutes on a Sunday evening is just a fraction of what actually goes on behind the scenes. So it was brilliant, though. I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
And so what you're saying, it really was difficult to keep those tight budgets in check, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, yes. I think out of all my episodes, I got one in on budget. So, yeah, so it was very tight.
Your fault or the client's?
Probably a mix of everything. Definitely not my fault.
Okay, good. And do you think the public actually know what a quantity surveyor does? And if not, what does a quantity surveyor do?
I think since the show, I think Patricia Power actually put us on the map when Room to Improve came on. When I said I was a surveyor, people thought I was that person on the road looking into theodolite. So they didn't really understand that it was about cost and contract. So basically, your quantity surveyor controls the cost and there are contractual obligations between a client and a builder. So we're very important and you all need one. if you're building your house, get yourself a quantity surveyor. So we manage risk, really, and we manage the client's risk. And then we also can work for the builder and we can manage the builder's risk as well. So we try to manage people's expectations and control the budget, but it is very hard.
What's not to love about risk management and being between the contractor and the client?
It's very it's very challenging. You do have to be very diplomatic and try not to side with both parties and be very fair and reasonable between both parties. But I totally enjoy it. I love my job, so I'm very lucky.
Well, we have loads of questions lined up for you, Lisa. So
I'll do my best.
Very good. Very good. So one of the first things that people tend to ask about their home is, you know, what is my home? How is my home performing at the moment? And we always tend to defer to a building energy rating or a BER. So, Jenny, can I just ask you, explain in 30 seconds the origins of and what is a BER?
The BER, the building energy rating, it's actually 12 years old this year. It came in on foot of European legislation, which had the ambition to put a rating on a house. So we all have an expectation of a rating on a fridge or a TV, but we don't have the same expectation for a house. So that's what this has taken over, which is fantastic, really, because it just puts energy as part of the sale of a house, and it is a good guide for somebody buying a house. At the moment, there's roughly 1.75 million homes in the state, and of that, there's over 800,000 BERs. So it would be great to transfer those figures over to 100%.
And so it's an A to G scale. So an A must be really easy to achieve, you know, with all with all the technologies and techniques we have today.
Unfortunately, we only currently have about 135 A1 houses in Ireland, which is a little bit surprising, given the increased interest in energy. But happily, the figures for A3s and A2s are really coming along steady, because I find it very unusual when I meet people at events that they don't realise that since 2012, the expectation is that a house that's built has to be an A3 minimum. Mm-hmm. This is a big surprise. But looking at the figures, they are beginning to come up, which is great. And now we have a new scenario where people who are living in houses older than 2012, and there are a lot of houses older than 2012 in the country, people living there are getting a sense of that they want to bring their BER up as well, or make their homes warmer, and they're getting a sense of what they need to do. It's slow, but we're getting there.
Yeah, and the regulations are changing again, Lisa, and we were just chatting there off air that the new regs coming in the end of this year are going to require an A2 as a minimum. Yeah. Do you think that that's going to add much to the cost of building relative to what we're building at the moment?
Not from an A3 to an A2, not really. And I have to say that developers have been very much aware in that I'm building houses at the minute with Bryphon Homes. And we have, you know, the last, I'd say, 5 years, their default now in relation to air to water and the insulation and the upgrading of the design to an A3 rating. So it's very common now. The costs have mellowed out. So I can't see a huge difference between your A2 and your A3 in relation to
cost. You're absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, you'll actually notice it even from a cultural perspective. You'll drive through housing estates and you won't see chimneys anymore.
No.
Which is, I think, is a big kind of realisation, and it kind of makes you realise that, developers definitely are and contractors are getting very clued up on what will bring it up.
It stems from the designer, to be honest with you. So the architects and that are now coming out. So we haven't sat down around the table and even discussed a gas or an oil boiler in the last 5 years. That's all air to water, heat pumps, solar panels, PV panels. So yeah.
And it's amazing when the action plan, a lot of people spotted that about the ban or the putative ban on oil and gas boilers, but you're saying now that in new build it's rarely being considered.
No, it's not. Well, not in the projects that I've been involved in, though.
Okay. And we get asked about probably the single most common question we get asked is what grants are available, and then there's a supplementary, why isn't there no grants for new build? So Brian, do you want to come in on the grants that are available today?
Yeah. Okay, we have, there's, I suppose, three broad categories grants. So we have grants for your insulation, so you improve the heat retention of the house, and it means you don't need much heating to run your house. So then you have the grants then for your heating systems, and then grants for additional renewables.
So Brian, can I just bring you back to one point there? One of the questions we get an awful lot is, why are there no grants for new build? I know you have the answer to that one.
Well, the primary purpose of our grant programmes is to incentivise homeowners in carrying out energy upgrades to their homes, especially where the homes have a poor energy performance, particularly older homes. And under the building regulations, any new builds now would be built to at least an A3 rating. And when the new building regulations come into effect in November, all new homes will be built to an A2 rating of that order. So new builds typically would have a high energy performance. So There's no need for grants there to incentivise the energy upgrade of those homes. We're looking at upgrading the poor performing homes in Ireland.
Great. So just going back to some of the questions that we get on that we've gotten online and that we get through our call centre. So someone has asked that, or Joan O'Brien has asked that, we are about to renovate a cottage and it's listed a protected structure. Can they apply for a grant? It's in poor condition.
I'll take that one. A protected structure is a very tricky. First of all, you have to check. So one will assess whether it's protected or not by checking the local register in the local authority. And for protected structures, it's not a given that a grant can be applied, because it would need to be, you need to work with the local authority on the best solutions for that. So no, it's not, I would not recommend that you just fire ahead and go for a grant.
Okay. And then Michael has said that he has no BER on his rental property that he's interested on because it's a listed building, and he was told that it is exempt. Now, not dealing specifically with Michael's property, can a property be exempt from a BER?
Yes, it can if it is protected. So that would be for temporary buildings, protected structures, as I mentioned, and buildings below 50 square metres. But just in terms of rental, which I'm glad you brought it up, because people who are going to try and rent apartments or houses, just protected or not, it has to have a BER. So a person looking for a home is entitled to ask that landlord for it.
Okay. And Lisa, just with your clients, do you think your clients are aware of the BER when they buy a property in the first instance, or do you have to introduce them to it?
No, it depends on the age of that client. I'm going to be honest with you. People now that are 30 or 35 have had smartphones since they were 12. So they're very aware in relation to BERs and I feel energy ratings. Possibly people that are that bit older, you'd have to explain from what a building energy rating cert is.
So Brian, we've talked there and we threw in a little bit of jargon, but I did say there was a jargon limit, so we try and avoid that. But we used the word retrofit, and the action plan that was published by the government action plan talks about upgrades or retrofits to B2. People talk about deep retrofits, they talk about deeper retrofits. Just jargon free zone, what is the range of retrofits or upgrades that people can do? Like, why is there such a range?
Well, typically we would have had through the grant programs, people might go for attic insulation or pump insulation to their cavity walls or upgrade their boiler. So they might do one or two of those, and you call that a shallow retrofit because they're smaller measures and it's not an extensive list of upgrades, and you're making a big difference to the property, but it's not an extensive list of measures where you're looking at the house as a whole house, as a system working together. So a deeper retrofit then as well, where you're looking at, say, insulating the walls, insulating the roof, consider upgrading the windows, depending on what you have. You're looking to upgrade your heating system, bring in things like mechanical ventilation as well, because your house is more airtight. So you're looking at a whole big list of maybe 5, 6, 7 measures that are retrofit measures where you're improving the energy efficiency of the house. It's much more extensive. It is more expensive, but you're making a significant difference to the rating of the house, making it much more energy efficient, and where everything works together as a system.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, Lisa, I just before we get into some of the more detailed questions, I want to ask you an easy one. How much does a retrofit cost?
How long is a piece of string?
Okay. Piece of string and a short piece of string.
I get asked this all the time, and it actually depends on that particular property. So there's a lot of criteria that comes into play. First of all, is what year is the property and how is it originally constructed? And then what measures needs to upgrade from whatever the existing BER rating is to what you want to achieve. So it is very hard to isolate figures or to broad stroke or generalize them.
Okay. And we will come back to some particular costs in a while. And by the way, you talk about upgrades and retrofit. Are those two words interchangeable? Do your clients talk about retrofits, or is it just us?
You're talking to a retrofit with a client, they would think you're just talking about retro, like going back into the 60s or something, right? So you have to kind of really explain to them that a retrofit is you're coming into an existing property and you're upgrading isolated fabrics of the building, windows, insulation, etc.
Yes. And so do you keep that as being the part that's the energy upgrade? The retrofit is the energy upgrade.
Yeah. Right. So what happens is with a particular client, when you're discussing budget and the energy upgrade, they can't see the niceties, as in, where's my kitchen, my bathroom, and my shiny tiles? Because a huge chunk of the budget has actually upgraded the energy, which means it's a more comfortable place to live for them over the years, and it's cost effective in relation to their energy bills are going to be greatly reduced. Mm-hmm. But they can't see that initially, so it does take quite a lot of convincing that they need to spend this money.
I think people struggle with that as well. Yeah. They look at energy efficiency and upgrades and insulation purely in terms of how much does it cost and how much is it going to save me on my bills, and not in terms of the comfort long term.
Yeah.
And as Jenny said, the health benefits of
the quality of living in a house. Yeah,
but they do notice it.
They do notice
afterwards.
Yeah. It is. They realise, God, it was much toastier this winter, and the bills weren't as expensive, and we hadn't got the heat on. As long.
So people do reflect back quite quickly that they are more comfortable, they're saving
absolutely
on the bills.
Absolutely, yeah. If we have called into people a year after we've retrofitted a house or done some energy upgrades, they can really notice the difference. Yeah.
Okay. So, Brian, we often talk about fabric first, which many people mightn't understand what it is. So what is fabric first and why is it so important?
Okay, fabric first is about insulating your house to a high degree, meaning you have wall insulation, roof insulation, high efficiency windows, because you reduce the amount of heat you need to use. You're retaining the heat in the house a lot longer. And the cheapest form of energy that you have is the energy you don't use. So if you have well insulated walls, roof, high efficient windows, then you don't have to run your heating system as much because you're retaining the heat in the house for a lot longer. So if you think of this analogy of a bucket of water that's full of water, as a high efficient home that's well insulated. The corollary to that then would be that if you've got a lot of holes in that bucket, then the water is just being lost out through it. So that's kind of the same as a house that's poorly insulated. You're losing all that water and the tap is running to keep it topped up. And take that back to a house, is you've got the heating on all the time to try and keep that house comfortable. So if you've got an older house that's poorly insulated, either it's very uncomfortable to live in, or you're running the heating around the clock to try and keep some level of comfort in the house. So to take back to fabric first, the important thing is that you look at the insulation and the efficiency of windows, because you want to keep the heat in the house for a lot longer, because it means you don't have to run the heating system for as long.
Okay. And you know, Lisa, most people would be familiar with attic insulation as a one of the first ones, and they see it because they're putting up their Christmas decorations or taking down the suitcases. But Brian on Twitter and Owen Kinsler have come back and asked about options on wall insulation. So Brian here mentioned the different types of wall insulation. What are the considerations about, how do you decide what one to go and what are the different implications of the different types?
Yeah, so I suppose from a wall insulation point of view, you can do it in two ways. You can do external wall insulation where you're wrapping the insulation around the outside of the house, or else you can go internally and you can dry line individual rooms. The external walls, you dry line on the inside of them. So considerations really would be obviously cost. I'm going to put the cost hat on here. Internal dry lining, you are upsetting the room as such, so you'd be taking off window boards, you'd be taking skirtings off. You do then what is, you would place a thermo board, which is an insulated plaster board on the walls that typically has to be skimmed, painted, skirting boards put on. So there's auxiliary costs than just actually buying the board and sticking them on the wall. If you're going external insulation, it's a little bit easier, it's less upset in that sense, where they'll wrap the insulation in around the outside of the building. You do have to change sills because the reveal depth has now increased, so you'd be planting on sills afterwards. And then also you need to get that insulation down past the ground level. So there will be some civils works around the house to kind of dig a trench around the house and get the plinth board down, nearly sitting on top of your foundation on the outside. So from a cost point of view, the external insulation does roughly be around 50% more expensive than the internal. However, the benefits are, there is no thermal bridging, and to explain that is that the full wall surface has insulation on it. Internal insulation, you can, when you're internal, on the inside you're going from floor to ceiling. So there is a bit of a gap between the floor level that you don't get insulated unless you're actually taking up floors and packing back insulation along your walls.
And is that a heat loss issue, or is there other risks with what you refer to as thermal bridging? Why are we so pernickety about that detail at the corners?
Well, it's basic physics, because hot air will go to the coldest spot in a room. And if there are any sort of moisture, which is common in Irish houses, it would rest on the ceiling, and it could manifest as mould. And a lot of us will be very familiar with mouldy houses here. So what we try to do is, when you're insulating a house, is you try to get a whole house solution. I don't want to get too technical about it, but that there will be no obvious gaps. Culturally, we would have been used to dry lining years ago, but external wall has really kind of come along in the last 10 to 15 years as the best practice solution for insulating.
And just on that then as well, that you want to bring it up to the attic insulation, because you could have a really good layer of external wall insulation in your house, but because you have that gap between at the roof and the wall junction, that you could get heat being lost out through there, and then it causes condensation, you get mould, this black patch along the junction of the wall and the roof.
So this is a really serious issue, that you need good quality workmanship to make sure that the works are done. It's not it's not just an aesthetic thing.
Yeah.
It has to work right as well as look right.
I think, as Jenny pointed out, it's a whole house solution in the sense that if you're doing one and knocks on to doing the rest of it, like the attic insulation, the wall insulation and more changing windows.
And the problem is, it's not that visible as well, that if you're bringing it up on the outside, the external wall just up to the soffit, and you can't, it just looks like your whole wall is covered, and then it's not as obvious then to the homeowner that there might be an issue down the line.
So Lisa, is there an advantage to doing all of these works together? You know, doing the wall insulation and your windows and the attic insulation together?
Yes, because you get the instant benefits of it, but I don't think sometimes it's feasible from a budgetary point of view. So you might isolate and get windows done 1 year, insulation done on the next year. So you can phase your works over a number of years.
But it is possible to address those risks that we just talked about as you're doing it.
Yeah, and you can do the benefit, I suppose, of having the SEI grants, is that you get individual grants back for those different pieces, elements of work, you know.
Okay, great. Mm. So Paddy Costello and Tim Bowler have both talking about the fact that they now have their house fully insulated. So they've done the fabric first, Brian, but they're now looking at what are the most efficient heating formats for their home and how will they heat their homes and their hot water. You mentioned earlier about heat pumps. So before we answer Paddy and Tim's question, what's a heat pump?
Okay, heat pump. Basically, everyone has a heat pump in their house in terms of how it works. A fridge is sort of operates like a heat pump. Like the fridge will pull energy from the fridge and dump it out behind. So that's why it's warm behind the fridge. So the heat pump operates in reverse in that it takes energy from the air outside, and that can be as low down as minus 15, minus 20 degrees Celsius, and extracts that, increases the pressure. Not to get too technical again, but if everyone's people of a certain age have probably pumped up a bicycle tire with an old hand pump. And the longer you pump it, it's hot, getting hotter. So if you increase the pressure of the air, it increases the temperature. So by increasing the pressure of that air in the heat pump, it heats that water and circulates that around your house. So essentially what that is doing is it's giving you a high efficiency. So for every 1 unit of electricity to run the heat pump, you're getting about 3.5 units of heat into the house. So it's a very efficient, in that instance, you would say 350% efficient heating system.
But not if your house isn't insulated.
Exactly. As I said earlier, it's not appropriate for every house. But in these instances, they said that the houses were well insulated. And that's fine. And that's the kind of system you look for if you've got a well insulated house. If you've got an older house, you would have to insulate that, bring up the level of insulation. Again, so you get the benefit from a heating system like a heat pump.
Okay,
for Paddy and Tim, it just sounds like the ideal situation, because people will say, I want to get a heat pump, and they don't really want to know what, or they may not be aware of what goes along with that. There's no point in having a state-of-the-art new heating system if it's just going out through cold walls. So the fact that they have their house is insulated means that they're actually heat pump ready, by the sounds of it, which is perfect. So in terms of the heating system that goes along with it, they have lots of choices because their heating system isn't going to have to work so hard. Heat pump sounds perfect, but I just from a personal perspective, the wood pellets are also very efficient, but they are could be expensive because they need a lot of storage. So unless you've got a great big store out the back, you'll have to be buying in small amounts. So it's case by case, really, yeah. Depending.
And what about solar panels? You know, are they feasible?
Oh, yes, they're very, again, case by case. A lot of people, again, going back to the ideal homes demographic, people think that they have to start with a renewable solar or thermal or solar electric, but that's not actually the case. It's kind of nice to think that you might use renewable energy from the sun, and Ireland is a very good country for light, so there's no reason why not to. But again, it comes at the end of the journey rather at the beginning. You do the fabric, get the heating system, and then support with the electric from the sun.
And just people who might have read the action plan heard about the putative ban on oil and gas boilers, and I know, talking to my mother, she was worried, would this affect her or not, because she's just got a new gas boiler. Oil and gas boilers will continue to exist. So are they a reasonable consideration in certain circumstances still?
Absolutely. I mean, there's plenty of people still have old inefficient boilers, and again, without any sort of level of control. So if you've got a boiler that's 15 years old, maybe it doesn't even sound that old when you talk about it, come back to the early 2000s, and your option would be to replace it with a condensing boiler that's probably 90% efficient versus your 65% efficient gas boiler, then that makes sense because you have a more efficient heating system, so your house is being heated more efficiently.
And sometimes you even have to explain it in a very easy to understand way to people. Say, look, you've got €1 that you're paying for your gas, but you're actually only getting 65 cent worth, as opposed to your 91p or your 91 cent from the brand new boiler, the gas boiler. But then you introduce the heat pump and you say you're actually generating 3 times the amount of energy back.
Yeah.
So they understand that from the financial perspective.
So, Lisa, over to you. Linda contacted us and bemoans the cost or expense of a deep retrofit. And a deep retrofit can be a very expensive undertaking. But you're looking at a couple of houses, not full deep retrofit, upgrading to a B2, which is still a super efficient home.
Yeah, so but I just brought in some examples today because, as I said, it's very hard to actually broad stroke costs. So I brought in an example. So it's South Dublin, four bed, semi-detached unit, approximately 1,200 square foot. So in that house, we changed the windows, we dry lined the inside of the walls, we upgraded the boiler and mechanical controls with painting, attic insulation. That came in, inclusive of VAT, of €57,000.
Right. So it's a considerable undertaking.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And is that just money into the ground? Is that something?
No, like? I mean, they have a far superior home in relation to comfort. They were really, you know, there was three children in this house, so they're really going to benefit from that. They won't see that probably until the winter time, and they will definitely notice the difference.
And that brings them to a B or B2.
Yeah. Yes. Well, actually, we went a step further on that house. I just isolated the B2 costings. It was a suspended timber floor, so we took out the floors and we insulated underneath the floors, which actually brought it up to a B1 standard, and it was an additional €5,000 on top of that.
So B1 is pretty much where the current building regulations are.
Well, new bills at the minute are A3.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. So it's very close.
Very close,
very close.
Yeah.
So it's possible to bring an old home up to
really
modern,
comfortable standards. Yes.
But you had another one that I think was a bit more expensive.
Yeah, so
basically, why might that be?
Yeah, I wanted to kind of contrast that. I took a traditional stone farmhouse in the Midlands of Ireland. It's approximately 1,800 square foot. And again, we did... you have to understand, I want to get back to the characteristics of the house. So this is a traditional stone house, so the technologies are different in relation to we use breathable material. So it was a breathable insulation on the inside. Also, what you have to take into consideration, there was traditional shutter boxes around each window, so they had to come off and go back on.
Mm.
Yeah. So there's little quirks in individual houses, and that's why I wanted to kind of show these two examples. So again, we had a slide and sash window, which again is going to be because we were trying to keep the character of the farmhouse, and that B2 rating came in at €80,000, including the VAT.
And if a person is undertaking, say, setting aside the grants, but a person's undertaking a deep renovation,
yeah,
how difficult a job do you have convincing them to consider the energy components, or do you ever...
It just goes back to, I suppose, it's not that it's lack of understanding, but when it's very emotional when you're actually undertaking a house build, because you really are looking at the niceties in relation to the kitchens and the bathrooms. And as I touched on before, social media have fantastic apps out there. So when they see a sizable amount of their money going towards energy upgrades where they can't see it tangibly, like it's behind a wall, people can get a little bit upset, you know. But you're trying to explain the benefits, and it's usually after they've moved in, mm-hmm, they come back and say, thank you so much. They're very grateful in relation to how you force them down a path of energy upgrades, but you haven't, you know, because I know the benefits that they're going to achieve, you know.
And do you see that, just one final question on that, do you find that among your colleagues in the QS and contracting space, that more and more people are becoming more au fait with it and doing the job of convincing homeowners to take it on?
Yeah, like I nearly feel that an architect or a designer, when they're going into a house to do major renovations, they, by natural default, specify products that are going to bring that property up to, you know, to a B2 and above. So it's there's no thought process really behind it, I don't think, anymore, that it's just by default that if we're dry lining, we're going to bring it up to really good standards and above that again.
Okay. So Jenny, Mary Douglas was on, and she contacted a company about getting solar panels. Now, this is solar PV for generating electricity. And she only needs 4, but she understood that the current grant will only give her a grant if she goes for 6. Is that correct?
Oh, no. Sorry, Mary. That maybe somebody might have given her the wrong information, or she. Yeah. I'm sure she didn't pick it up. But there's actually a planning consequence aside from that. No, we actually give grants based on the output.
Yeah, it's essentially on the self-consumption. So the whole idea of that particular grant pilot was to give it for people that they're only generating as much as they'd actually use. So it's up to, say, of the order of 6 panels that you'd put on your roof, but you don't necessarily have to put that, because a smaller house with less people in the house would need less. So you might need 3-4 panels. So it's dependent on your circumstances. You can go above the five, four, six panels if you're getting battery storage as well, because then you're moving beyond what you'd actually use and you'd need something to store. Because the thing is, solar PV doesn't necessarily work for everyone, because if you've got, say, two people in the house and they're out all day when the sun's generating the electricity, and unless you have some form of storing it, then it's basically wasted energy that's going back on the grid, and you've basically invented in or invested in a system and you're not seeing the benefit of it. So it doesn't necessarily suit everyone, but it's the whole idea of that particular grant is that it's self-consumption, that you're only sizing it based on what you need for your house.
Yeah, and the standard four panel seems to be pretty good for an average size house, is what we're finding.
And is there, can people get paid for the power that they're putting onto the grid?
Not at the minute. Electric Ireland did have a trial that finished maybe in 2016, but there is talk in the Climate Action Plan that there would be a feed-in tariff similar to what they have in the UK, where all the electricity that you generate but you don't use and goes back in the grid, then you get paid for that. And that would make sense. It would mean that a lot more people would invest in solar PV because they can get the benefit from it, and then but they also get paid for what they don't use, and the national grid then gets the benefit of all that renewable electricity going back onto the grid.
So the, one of the things that was mentioned in the discussion around the deep retrofit is, you know, wrapping the building, windows, heating, but airtightness. And airtightness could bring to mind, you know, suffocation, you know, no air. What is airtightness?
It's no drafts.
Right.
So drafts, pet hate, number one. Drafts, I think the regulations call it uncontrolled infiltration of air. But drafts in a house, which everybody here knows about. Yeah, we're going from the absolute polar opposite of drafty houses that we grew up in, now becoming very insulated and, as you say, airtight. And that does mean that we need to introduce some form of assisted air intake, which is, most people would know, as mechanical ventilation. And that takes the air in and every couple of times an hour. And the quality of the air is kept constant across the day. So that is, so if you are insulating to a high level, this is something that your professional is going to suggest to you, and that is absolutely necessary.
I think it's important as well. It's like, if you've a house that's not, the airtightness hasn't been addressed, but you've gone for a high degree of insulation, it's basically heat bypassing that insulation being lost outside, as well as the drafts. So again, the analogy would be like buying a really expensive warm winter coat, but leaving it open when it's very cold outside. So the heat's all being lost out through that. So you're not getting the full benefit of that jacket, in the same way as you wouldn't get the full benefit of the insulation if you're not addressing the airtightness. It is something we do get asked a lot. If you make a house very airtight, is that an issue then? And are you making the house unhealthy? And that's why we'd look at the benefit of mechanical ventilation. So whether it be demand control ventilation, where you're taking out that when the house gets, when you're cooking or using bathrooms, it pulls that wet, stale air out of the house, and then replace it with fresher air. And then mechanical ventilation with heat recovery is where you're extracting that warm air from the house and you're passing the heat onto the fresh incoming air. So you're keeping the heat fresh, but you're keeping that fresh incoming air warm.
And Lisa, I'm sure you've done mechanical ventilation with heat recovery in a number of homes. What's the reception of that for the homeowners? How do they take it? Because it's different. We're not used to sort of air conditioning, I suppose, in homes.
Yeah, and I mean, in fairness, they would take on board the specialist advice. So, like, there's, like what Brian said, there's no point in insulating the fabric of the building and then punching a hole in the wall. You know, the old hit and miss vents where you're actually sticking the piece of cardboard on it in the winter. That those days are gone. People are becoming more aware and they're taking the advice on board. So the mechanical ventilation, again, and all the new properties that we're doing, they're default. We're either doing demand control or heat recovery. So it's becoming standard.
And some people we meet at the Ideal Homes as well, that they think that mechanical ventilation is going to have big silver metallic pipes going throughout the house.
Yeah, it's all concealed.
That's very intrusive. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So the demand controlled as well in each individual room. It's very similar to your hit and miss vent, but it probably comes off the wall by around an inch and a half. It's a little box. So it's not too intrusive in the room either.
But if a person is doing just one measure, like, let's say, doing cavity wall insulation or external insulation, they still will need wall vents. And if they do the attic, they'll still need a lot of ventilation in the attic along the soffits. Why is that? That's different ventilation to...
Because when you're going to the deep retrofit, say your A3, your step to get the A3 is this air tightness. So that's typically a membrane that would go up at ceiling level, and then you're it's a tape that go around the window. So like you are stopping all of that. So when the B2, if you're doing individual upgrades, you're not taking that step to the air tightness as such.
Okay.
Yeah. And just as I personally experienced when I first moved into my own house, there was a reasonable level of insulation in the attic, but there was seemed to be no ventilation. And what we found over time, when I first got brave enough to go up into the attic to see the mess that was there, there was a lot of sweating on the felt because there's no ventilation. And then when there was the warm, wet air coming up out of the bathroom, and I was just sweating, and there was dropping everywhere as the insulation was wet. And it was going to potentially be an issue with the rafters then down the line.
Yeah, I was just going to say exactly that it's a fundamental misunderstanding that a lot of people have about living in a home, that it needs to breathe itself. So your normal behavioural habits, such as would have referred to before, drying your clothes on a radiator in a house is going to bring extra unwanted moisture. So you'll know when you use the shower, you should really open the window, or there should be some mechanical extract to clear it. It's less an energy issue, it's more a health environment for people living in a home. And it's one thing I keep coming across looking at all the surveys of homes that we have. I've yet to see, like we would have people saying, why are you putting a hole in my wall? I didn't have a hole there before. And you're going, well, there's mold in your house, and that's why we're putting it in. So that's part of the program that I'm on, is that while we're assessing for energy upgrades, we're also assessing it for indoor air quality and from a health perspective. So, for example, if you have the regulations call as a heat producing appliance, which is actually could be an open fire or a gas fire, you have to have a permanent background opening in your wall. And more often than not, this will be stuffed with newspapers or a towel or just covered over. And, you know, ultimately, that's a very unhealthy habit for the homeowner. So we try and fix those when we're in.
And Lisa, just back to the cost issue and the different approaches. If a person's if a homeowner is undertaking attic insulation, they see that as a weekend job, a tradesman. But if you're doing a deeper retrofit, like the project you set out there, that's a project.
That's a proper project. That's you moving out of your house. For the deep retrofit, you're not going to be living in the house while this work is going on.
And then you threw about a bit of jargon earlier of prelims and contingencies. Now, come on.
Yeah, okay.
What are they?
So prelims are a cost that you actually can't quantify. So basically, as a quantity surveyor, we do what we say. We quantify everything. So we can go in and we can take a measure on the square meterage of a wall. But a prelim is an item that's not particularly measurable. So it would be skips, scaffolding, supervision in relation to if they had a foreman over a number of weeks on that site, builder's insurance, cleaning on completion. So that is kind of...
Toilets.
Toilets. So it's an umbrella term for those types of items that can't be quantified and a rate put against.
And contingencies then?
Contingency is for the unforeseen. And typically as well, when I was explaining about this particular job that we have in Kildare at the minute, which was a much older house that we were going in to do some superficial works, and then we uncovered dry rot, wet rot, etc. So it's a sum of money that is for unforeseen. And when you're dealing with older properties, you don't know what's gone on behind walls. So it's just a chunk of money, yeah.
I don't envy you.
No.
So we're just close to finishing up now. So just a quick fire question. If a person approaches you and are talking about an energy upgrade, what's the first step, or where did they start?
Personally, for me, I would get an energy assessor in to do what is called a deep assessment on your home. So they're going to tell you what measures you need to upgrade from whatever rating you have. That then becomes a specification of works, and then your professional can price that for you. So you can either do it in one go, or you can phase it over a number of years. So
okay, Jenny, that was probably your answer. So where would you go from there?
Okay, it's more, I suppose, information for the homeowner. Don't think you need to start at the most expensive items, such as our nice panels on the roof. the quickest gains for any homeowner is to take control of their own drafts and remove those as within your own financial constraints. And then, as Lisa was saying, go a little bit further and find out more of the bigger picture stuff.
Brian, anything left to say?
Yeah, Jenny stole most of my lines, but essentially using that the BR assessor as a sort of roadmap. So it not necessarily you have to go to it in one go, but look at where you get the most bang for your buck. So maybe you start off with your roof insulation, you dress your drafts, but seeing what, looking at it as a bigger picture, what do I need to do then line? So either you do it all in one go, or look at, well, I'll do the roof now and I'll upgrade my heating system next year and then I could get the walls insulated. But just have a plan, because then you can, it just becomes a more structured thing and you end up with a better house at the end of it.
And it's just phasing the works in a proper sequence so that work that you're doing in year one is not going to be undone by something that you're doing further on down the line. So it's just getting the proper sequence in order as well.
I'll come back to one thing as well. It's always good. I know it's very hard for people to challenge their own beliefs and habits, but I've done quite a good job recently of getting people to, on my own street, to move away from maybe closing up their chimneys, actually changing from a gas open hob to electric just to try new things, read up on these small changes that you can make that will help you in the future and brilliant. Economically too.
Brilliant. Okay, so we've gone through an awful lot of queries today, and my thanks to all those people who sent them in on Facebook and Twitter. I hope it's all been of use to you. Many thanks to Lisa O'Brien for joining us today, Jenny Power and Brian McIntyre.
Thank you, Tom.
If you want to find out anything more about the grants or just about how to upgrade the home, you can visit our website on www.seai.ie. Until next time, goodbye.
180 Degrees is brought to you by the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland. Join us next time when we'll be talking about the role businesses have in tackling climate change. Don't forget to subscribe to the show, and there's more at seai.ie/podcast. You can also follow us on Twitter and use the hashtag SEAI Podcast.